Well, let's make a start. David Broder is going to just lead off the discussion.
Let's meet something to lead off with.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
So you can both, make a contribution, can't you?
Yeah.
Do you want to go first, or David go first?
David can go first.
And then you can come in, and then we'll take it from there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Okay. So the topic we agreed at the end of the last meeting was the right of the far right and anti-fascism. So I'm going to talk mainly, though, about the BNP specifically, rather than sort of fascism in general or historically. So I thought to sort of introduce the discussion, I'll talk about how the BNP has grown, why they've been able to do so. Then I'm going to talk about different approaches to how the far right might be resisted, including official or establishment anti-fascism, no platform, the sort of Antifa or bash the fash kind of approach, and then more general ideas about how within the workers' movement we can fight racist ideas. Okay, so firstly, on the growth of the BNP, I think it's of course important to recognise how quickly the BNP has grown. In 1996, the BNP had 400 members, and today the BNP has 14,000 members, so growing more than 30 times in only 14 years. Moreover, in the European election, the BNP won 950,000 votes, almost a million. Put in some context, the Labour Party had 2.3 million votes, so obviously significant force electorally. Also, of course, now two members of the European Parliament and 60-odd councillors. This has not only meant that they have members of kind of various institutions, but also given a lot of confidence to the far right, as is now expressed in the English Defence League, and also its subsidiaries, the Scottish Defence League and the World Defence League. So those are not directly linked or merely fronts for the BNP, but they reflect that the far right is now confident enough to go out into the streets and present themselves and stand up for what they do, whereas in the 80s and 90s they were too afraid to do so. Partly, of course, thanks to such movements as AFA, Anti-Fascist Action. In response to this very quick rise of the BNP, a lot of the organised far left has chosen to line up with the Labour Party and the British state. Perhaps in the media or to many of the public, the best known anti-fascist organisation is Unite Against Fascism, a front for the Socialist Workers' Party. I think that to understand why that organising approach is wrong, we need to look a bit at why the BNP has grown. I mean, the strong election results they had last year were very much in response to the MP's expenses scandal, but also to the current economic crisis. Obviously, provided a breathing space or breeding ground for the far right. The BNP are anti-establishment. They denounce the bankers, they denounce MPs, the political class. They reflect a inherent and traditional trait in fascist groups, which is to pose as both reactionary, going back to the old ways, Britain in the 50s when everyone was white, the monarchy, the army, very strong in their values, of course, the traditions of the British state. But they also have a certain radicalism in their opposition to the political elite and the the boss's class. In response to this, as I say, a lot of people on the left say, well, we have to vote Labour to keep out the BNP, we have to support this, we have to support bourgeois democracy against fascism. For example, Simon Darby, the deputy leader of the BNP, was recently on a radio debate with Wayman Bennett, SWP leader, who is the leading organiser of United Against Fascism. Simon Darby said the crisis was caused by the bankers, international finance, of course, in a way reflecting a fascist idea of the problem with the crisis, not capitalism, but finance. To which the SWP member in United Against Fascism responded, well, the BNP aren't a legitimate party, all the legitimate parties understand the BNP have no solutions to the crisis, they're not going to restore the system to equilibrium. By which he meant Labour and the Tories are for bailing out the banks, and the BNP are too radical, they don't understand how to run the economy properly. Similarly, at the moment, we have a lot of the left calling for a vote for the Labour Party. So for example, recently saw a photo of the RMT Cleaners rep on the London Underground, a member of the SWP, some of the leading people of their group in the sort of migrant workers campaigns, standing with Margaret Hodge, the Labour MP for Dagenham, with a banner saying Dagenham rejects the BNP. Margaret Hodge is an outspoken advocate of British jobs for British workers, British homes for British workers. So they side with Labour Party racism over BNP racism. Also, a lot of what they say the BNP are criminals, they're not a normal party, they're not a legitimate party. Whereas in fact, a lot of the appeal for the BNP is that they're seen as anti-establishment. But secondly, many on the far left also have criminal records because under the British state, if you stand up for workers against bosses, you're going to run in trouble with the law, which is designed to protect such interests. Many people, of course, arrested under anti-union laws and so on. And related to that is a tactical question. Some people say, you know, there should be a state ban on the BNP. Say, you know, a democratic system can't accept Nazis. Sounds fair enough. Obviously, in a general sense, obviously, you know, ordinary bourgeois democracy is better than fascism. But actually, such state bans are always used against workers trying to organise on the left more than they are against fascists. That's not just a sort of historic example of something that happened in the 30s. If you look at last year, the BNP had their Red, White and Blue Festival, a fascist gathering. They have a camp. You know, they get together, they have some speeches by Nick Griffin and so on. And yeah, they sing their SS marching tunes and all that. And the police in Codner, the village in Derbyshire where it was held, they set up checkpoints at the roads in and out of the village, and they asked people who wanted to come into village for that weekend, you had to show a BNP membership card to be able to use the road to get into the village. Yeah. Any call for the state to decide what is or is not acceptable political behaviour always rebounds on its opponents from the left as well as from the right. I'm not saying, however, that we should mount a sort of liberal defence of free speech for the BNP. We shouldn't be for, you know, demanding the state ban them or the Labour Party ban them or whatever. But nor in principle are we in favour of their right to organise. We should absolutely be willing to break up their meetings, stop them from speaking, anything like that. But that's not limited to the BNP or the far right. For example, the day before the last general election, a few friends and I, Michael Howard, then the leader of the Tory party, was speaking on the High Street, Guildford. But, you know, we didn't think, oh, he has his right to free speech, so we have to accept it. But nor is it, oh, he's so beyond the pale of acceptable or legitimate politics, we can't let him speak. Rather, it's, you know, he is our opponent, we want to stop him from organising effectively, so stop it happening. And we did. We caused so much disruption, they couldn't use the footage of the meeting, so, you know, he didn't get his message across. What is different about the BNP from other bourgeois parties is that they organise direct, ad hoc violence against migrant communities and also against, for example, worker activists. In the one of the readings for the meeting was Anarchist Federation article, Bash the Fash, which made a very correct point that against fascists, we just rely on the sort of force of argument or like rational debate. It's not like, you know, you meet up with Nick Griffin and have an argument and try and win him round to persuade him. However, the people we do want to argue around, the people we do want to fight for in a battle of ideas, are the people who vote BNP or might consider voting BNP. Almost 1 million people vote for the BNP, but there are not almost 1 million fascists in Britain. So, while I think absolutely we shouldn't adopt pacifist tactics towards the BNP or shirk from the idea of violent confrontation, because that's, well, for example, also the EDL, English Defence League, that's what they want to do as well. They want to terrorise immigrant communities, they want to terrorise Muslim people in particular, but marching up and down, showing how strong they are. So to that, we don't just call for the state to ban them, nor should we just sort of argue with the ideas they put forward. That should be confronted. Communities should self-organise against that. But in terms of strategy against the far right, I'd say that there's a big politics underlying it are more important. The BNP's ability to grow is because they are the main anti-establishment force in Britain. The main people standing up to the elite politicians, whatever. Obviously, it's all very vague because they have any sort of class politics, but they trade on the fact that most politicians are reviled, and the BNP have a sort of populist anti-elite bent. They're not just racists. Also, for example, they a lot of the stuff they do, they, for example, in East London, places like Dagenham, Barking, Newham, they, which is one of their strongholds, obviously. I know, obviously, also places like Barnsley are strongholds of theirs, but I don't know so much about there. But they do fortnightly community newsletters. And it's not just racist stuff, it's about cuts, it's about housing, privatisation. Sometimes they add a racist gloss to that. They say, you know, there's no housing because of all the immigrants. But sometimes they don't. They can appeal to people on another basis too. A sort of like traditionalist, sort of the kind of traditional like British welfare state kind of thing. As against like labour cuts. So firstly, it's obvious that, you know, there's no substitute f- for real community organisation fighting the BNP. Like, when you get these, like, electoral campaigns by left groups, and they sound under a different name every time, and different politics and stuff, yeah, that's a really pathetic counterweight to the BNP, who, you know, do attempt to establish some real presence. You know, they do go around, you know, knocking on doors, listening to people, doing surveys, producing newsletters, all that kind of thing. But also, I think something we have to recognise is that British society is very racist. And a lot of people's attitudes towards immigrants are well to the right of their politics and other issues. I mean, it's not surprising the BNP should be strong, given the kind of stuff they say. For example, I looked up some opinion polls on the web, found a recent one. 59% Ipsos Maria, 59% of people think there's too many immigrants in Britain, 58% of people think parts of Britain are no longer recognisable as British because there's too many immigrants, 49% of people think the government should encourage immigrants to go home. And I stress that I'm not just saying, you know, to fight the fascists, what we really need to do is fight fascism. True as that is, that might sound rather abstract. But I think we have to look at who it is who's actually attacking immigrants in Britain. Because the migrant worker campaign, as I know, and you know, something I'm involved in myself, so Latin American workers, for example, like Latin American cleaners organising the city, at the front of their concerns is not the BNP. It's what the government's doing. The government deports thousands of people every year. There are 700,000 illegal immigrants in Britain. And employers, like, for example, cleaning contractors in the city or restaurant owners and so on, are happy to employ undocumented workers. But as soon as those workers start to stand up for themselves, as soon as they say, actually, I'm not going to work below minimum wage, that's when they shop them into the UK Borders Agency. There's not necessarily any dynamic link between migrant workers' struggles and fighting against the BNP. And actually, there's often things the left separates. On the one hand, everyone's in favour of organising migrant workers. Then at the same time, saying, oh, we have to vote for the Labour Party to keep out the BNP. True, there is that the BNP are not an ordinary party in the sense that they, you know, their members actually go around, you know, beating up immigrants. We can't join in the sort of moralistic, you know, sort of, oh, they're not a legitimate party, when the Labour Party uses state power to lock up in prisons for up to 2 years immigrants and deport them. That state violence is a much greater threat to migrant workers than the BNP. So as well as organising migrant workers' struggles, having that at the heart of the workers' movement, and indeed as a way of reinvigorating the labour movement, in terms of fighting fascism, we also have to revive community organisation and community presence for communist politics. A lot of people vote BNP. You know, I'm not saying, like, we knock on doors of individual BNP voters and we can easily win them round to left politics. Not at all. But it's also the case that the BNP are strong because they have community presence, and that is something the left has abandoned. To win the wider battle of ideas, we always have to build real organisations based on communities organising themselves, not just the left turning up every 5 years and saying vote for us or vote for Labour because the BNP are fascists, but rather to build a movement which can turn discontent with the system or the elite or whatever the BNP call it voting for a positive alternative, indeed one including migrant workers, rather than resorting to kind of scapegoating and sort of populist politics of the BNP.
Okay, thanks, David. Comrade, do you want to make a contribution, and then we'll open it up for discussion and debate. Okay.
Yeah, well, that kind of somewhat stole my thunder, but covering a lot of points that I was going to make, and also may have to rush out quickly to meet someone with news coming from Leeds at the station. But yeah, just to touch on a few more things. Yeah, unless I have to go to the station now. No, it's alright. Obviously you can't look at the voice of the BNP without looking at the conditions that made it, and I think that vital to that is that you have to look at the collapse of any kind of popular working class support for New Labour, because the narrative that's quite common on the left, and I think is broadly quite accurate, is that at one time a lot of people who had some kind of vague aspirations for some sort of social change, they wouldn't necessarily recognise themselves as socialist communists, but did have some measure of discontent with existing society, would channel that through voting for the Labour Party, and over the last kind of like however many years you want to call it, 30, 20, whatever, Labour has come so effectively shared any kind of leftist rhetoric it may once have possessed, and become so clearly and unambiguously a party of big business that it's now very difficult for anyone except kind of like the most blinkered and delusional of leftists to kind of hold out any belief in the possibility that voting for Labour will bring about social change. And so there's been kind of like that collapse of working class support for Labour, which we've seen in ever-increasing abstention at the polls, and it does seem to be the case that, like, instead of choosing to express their discontent by sitting in small rooms above pubs having communist discussion groups, a lot of people are choosing to articulate their discontent through nationalist politics. The other crucial thing to touch on is I thought your analysis of BNP was very good, but it's also worth considering the ways not just that it differs from tradition from normal liberal political parties, but also the way it's differed from traditional fascist parties, because if you look at fascist parties from like Mussolini to through to Hitler through to like Mussolini and British Union fascists through to the National Front through to the British National Party in the 1980s, they all kind of had a shared common strategy of controlling streets through violence, and now it's certainly like still the case that individual BNP members still indulge in violence, and there was that case just last month of the BNP member not that far from here who was found to be building a massive stash of explosives, but in general the party no longer endorses street violence, and it's not interested in having a street presence in the same way that the National Front, for instance, was always obsessed with. And so it's also changed its rhetoric quite a lot. It's kind of completely dumped all the anti-Jewish stuff because they've belatedly come to the recognition that the sort of so-called Jewish state of Israel is actually quite good at killing Muslims, which is something they approve of very strongly. And now that their rhetoric is just a sort of slightly amplified version of the rhetoric the mainstream parties are coming out with, which is enough of the challenge for the sort of mainstream ruling class anti-fascists, because it sort of puts their arguments in a schizophrenic position where they can't challenge the logic of the BNP's arguments by openly coming out and saying that like immigration isn't bad and that Muslims aren't scary, because that would completely belie everything else they've been saying, and it would also earn them the hostility of the tabloid media, which none of the mainstream parties want to get. So I think that in connection with this, with some kind of changing strategies for the BNP, it's also worth looking at the problems with the militant anti-fascist no platform tradition when it comes to confronting this, because when you were talking about old style fascist groups like the British Union of Fascists was, or the National Front was, or even the BNP was at its foundation, then kind of militant no platform stuff is absolutely the best way to confront it, because they're all about trying to gain presence on the street to but the present BNP has no real interest in street violence. They're all about trying to build kind of trying to mass communicate their ideas. And if you look at militant anti-fascist organisations like ANFA, by their nature, because of the work they can, because of the kind of work they do, they have to be clandestine organisations. They can't really do mass public publicity and propaganda work. So they always still think those organisations have one very important role to play. They absolutely cannot be the be-all and end-all, because the fascists have changed, and our tactics need change to reflect that. The only other thing I want to touch on was the EDL, because they've kind of suddenly appeared from nowhere in the middle of 2009 and completely turned things around, because in contrast to the BNP kind of moving away from boots and towards suits, so I'm completely abandoning the street in favour of electoral publicity stuff. The EDL are all completely about street violence, and a lot of people found it like quite hard to work out what their ideology is, because they've had the members waving Israel flags, as well as the people burning anti-Nazi symbols, and famously they have had people giving sigils on their demonstrations. But again, it's sort of hard to say how far that reflects the EDL as a whole, because I'm sure a lot of people here will have experience of going on kind of like big liberal lefty demonstrations, selling tiny communist or anarchist newspapers, or with red and black flags or whatever, and us being on those big liberal demonstrations in no way means it's going to be an anarchist or communist demonstration. It's a liberal demonstration with a few anarchists or communists on it, and think although I can't claim to speak with authority because I'm not a member of the EDL and haven't been on their demonstrations, I think there is at least a possibility that something similar is happening with the EDL and fascist presence there. And they do seem to have like a fair bit of money and organisation for a group that just appeared out of nowhere. There's a lot of speculation about that, and whether they're backed by the state, whether they're backed by the BNP, because in their public speeches they've always been very keen to dissociate themselves from BNP. But again, that's kind of a grey area of speculation that no one really knows truth about. They have famously been able to attract some black members to their demonstrations, which they kind of is nowhere near as important as they'd like to make out. But I think we shouldn't be at all surprised by it, because they are, above all else, an anti-Muslim group, and there's no contradiction between being black and being anti-Muslim. It's only been a few years since we saw the riots at Lozelle's in Birmingham, which sort of pitted the black community against the Asian community. So we should be under no illusions that being from an ethnic minority automatically means the person's going to have perfect anti-racist conscience. And especially not against the extremely vilified group like Muslims. So yeah, that was most of it, I think.
Okay, thanks, Cameron. Kip, can we open it up then? Who wants to make a start? Yeah, come on.
Yeah, I can. Like Stuart mentioned in the talk, the BNP undoubtedly they do have a populist and a certain kind of radicalist streak. I don't think that explains the phenomenon of the rise of the far right in the recent past. I believe, like, if you look historically at when you have the most obvious example of in the 30s in the aftermath of defeating of the working class through defeating the revolutionary wave and the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression and so on, it was those conditions that rise in the light today when you have this kind of crisis, when capitalism is in open crisis, that it is this that kind of puts energy into the far right to grow out. So I reckon I think that I would disagree too with David's uncritical comments on militant anti-fascism, because the problem with the far right, well, the reason that the far right grew is because reactionary ideas have a widespread purchase within British society, and even where I come from, Ireland, increasingly they do as well. And that the very fact by attacking either BNP or EDL demonstrations, you are not attacking them. It is the purchase of those ideas within society which needs to be attacked, which is where I disagree. And there's other stuff, I'll come back to the discussion on some of this.
Okay, apparently I'm chairing, so did anyone else want to add anything to that?
And then maybe I could say if it was, I think I would follow with the last speaker with what you said. Sorry, yeah. I think we need to look on the statistic you said about the growth. It's quite alarming in a way in such a period, you know, fascism. Then why this is moving? Why this is rising, the number of the like you rightly say they are not all fascists there, but nonetheless they're voting for this idea. Many aspects to it. Fundamentally, I agree with this economic crisis and it's giving that energy there. But more specific on politics side is some of the things. The question is appealing for, if you like, non-political people in working class area. Some of these immigration things are problem. Left is, it's very difficult for British left to pick it up because it will be accused of being racist. But at the same time, those idea for ordinary people coming problem is a real problem. And left is always, not now, in 80s, even 70s, they ignored or they don't dare to face it. For example, now some of these Muslims movement is a restriction, is freedom of the speech. Left doesn't dare to be critical of them, you know, because they will be accused of being a racist. But communist socialists cannot be that sort of politician, being diplomat and talking diplomatically. Left should be critical of some of the restrictions this minority is imposing in Europe or other places. Now, criticizing a religious person is almost becoming forbidden because left is supporting that one. Oh, you can't insult. You can't be free to say things because that will be insulting to so-called Muslims community. For communists, there is no Muslims community. For communists, it's either workers community or non-workers or middle-class communities. They cannot ignore their own weakness, which in order... Otherwise, the biggest problem is then tendency towards right-wing politics within the working class will rise, and neither left nor this demonstration ever going to be stopped. That's what happened in before the Second War. Because you're not criticizing the certain things might need, then working class will go for. Because there are certain things minorities does, or Islamist movement does, and they don't like it. And they don't like it, they rightly they don't like it. Why they want some restriction in their, if you like, traditional way? Because now a mosque is here, you can't do that, or this Muslim community is in there, and you can't say that. Almost they've restricted freedom of speech, and this restriction is not coming from ordinary people, it's coming from powerful oil money-driven mullahs or in the Middle East. It's not, you know, big capitalists behind it, but capitalism will benefit that one. Because in Europe, they can easily impose restrictions on civil liberties under the name of this sort of restriction that community believes in. So, to conclude my saying, left should be critical of that minority as well. They shouldn't be scared of being accused of racist. At the same time, like you were saying, the end of the day, only working class movements can stop this rise of fascism, not you know, anti-fascist demonstration or anti-fascist you know, sort of statement to give out.
Any response for that from somebody who's not spoken?
Well, I don't think it's like necessarily the anti-religious point that the left should be afraid of associating with on the right. It's the populist point. Like, you don't want to get associated with this like populist disavowal of what the proper problem is by saying, well, the Muslims are the big problem. So we really have to be critical beyond that. So I just don't feel that it's necessarily an issue that we should be dealing with is Islamic repression of freedom to speech. It's not the big issue. It's really not what we should be dealing with. And in dealing with that, it's just a kind of inverse populism.
Well,
an inverted image
of... Why is this idea of communist appealing within the working class, in other words, this right-wing idea or BNP or whatever they are, why within the working class people are thinking they got something to say or in a way to defend their interests?
Why do they think the BNP are...
Yes.
Oh, but I think that a lot of what the BNP stand for does seem to the working class to defend their interests. I mean, really, like these things about nationalisation of industries, this kind of revolution without a revolution kind of idea, appeals to a lot of working class people.
Isn't it more to do with being entrenched? Like, one set of immigrants, if they get entrenched, kick against the next set of immigrants that come across.
Yeah, and this is the populist thing. It's the easy answer of, oh, well, this is what the problem is. It's the Islamic.
I don't think that's necessarily true, because the working class is itself a class of immigrants. Like, I come from Ireland, where literally every family has a history of immigration to either Britain or America. I think it's more to do with the kind of the retreat and confidence and consciousness of the working class through the defeats over the last couple of decades, and it's disorientation that has, when you see this kind of trend towards right populist sort of politics that are taking hold.
Anybody else who has spoken?
Yeah, just I do think it is necessary to be critical of Islamism and religious extremism, but in a balanced way that does take into account that those criticisms are manipulated by the establishment and the like of the BNP, you know, for their purposes. But I do think we'd be betraying our message if we were to kind of water down our politics. But it is a balance that, you know, a careful balance that we need to strike, I think. But I definitely don't think we should avoid criticising Islamism altogether, for example. I don't think it's the major priority, of course, but I do at the same time think it should be something that we do talk about.
So-called non-political people, they are not political, but, you know, part of the working class, decent life. I mean, when they come in raising issues such as these Islamists' restriction on the speech or in some sort of activities or the, you know, certain things they're promoting, what would be your answer to these people? They're saying, this is the problem. What would you say? Say, no, that's not the problem?
Quite a lot of points. Sorry. It's important to let other people have their say as well.
Sure.
So appreciate if you didn't keep jumping in and, you know, making even more points. You've made a number of points and people are trying to respond to them. I mean, personally, I don't think you should equate the situation of Muslims in this country with a capitalist state. It's not true the capitalist state is in favour of freedom and democracy. The whole point about fascism is this: that fascism is just an extreme... If you look at the history of fascism, right, it's about... If you look at capitalism isn't just about democracy, okay? It's not just about democracy. That's just one form of capitalist rule. It quickly can degenerate into military dictatorship or fascism. Fascism is an extreme form of the capitalist state. Do you understand? So you can't simply counterpose... bourgeois democracy with Muslims. You seem to be targeting the Muslim community and, you know, equating it with the capitalist state. And I think that's a mistake.
I don't think that's what was being said. We've got to be very, very careful not to be critical of things that the state really tells us not to be critical of through this political correctness. I don't think it was a direct attack on anybody's
belief. I was just making the point that historically capitalism and capitalist democracy can quickly degenerate into military dictatorship or fascism. And if you look, say, at the history of, say, Germany and Italy, where you had bourgeois democracy, the fascists didn't come to power by street fighting. They came to power constitutionally. They were actually invited into power by the top bourgeois politicians. So, you know, they didn't fight their way to power. They were invited in through bourgeois democracy. So, did you want to make some points? I think
you're
next.
Sorry, obviously I'm aware of much while already, so thank you. Brendan, I certainly didn't mean to suggest that I was in favour of militant anti-fascism in the sense you described. I mean, the point of my quoting statistics about
I was more
racist
attitudes
in society were...
I was more referring to uncritical comments on AFA and so on and stuff like that.
No, I mean, I would be critical of them in that, as I said, the number of people who vote BNP, you have to address the underlying political issues, not just to like go around beating people up. But my overarching point, though, is that the level of state violence against the workers' movement or against migrants is much greater and a more pressing threat than the BNP. And it's also the case that a lot of BNP voters are ex-Labour voters, so it's not much good going around going, oh, vote Labour against the BNP, because they might be disaffected from Labour. You know, it's not that like Labour's become soft on immigrants, not at all. And, you know, the reason people ditch the Labour Party reflects certain real grievances about what the Labour Party's become. So, no, I don't at all... I think migrant worker organising and challenging the implicit racism of the trade union movement is more important than fighting the BNP. An example, the class struggle in general and anti-racism are not necessarily interlinked, but they should be. For example, the RMT on the London Underground is very well organised, very militant, lots of strikes, you know, all that. But to be honest, you know, if a train driver rep gets victimised, and you know, they're well-paid workers, like probably exclusively like white, British, 40 grand a year or that, occasions when those workers have been victimised, the RMT always stands up in militant defence for them. When the cleaners went on strike, almost entirely black, African, recent immigrants, a lot of them undocumented workers. 50 were sacked because of the strike. 2 were deported. The RMT reaction was much less than it would have been for 1 driver. Of course, there's, you know, it's not that the RMT leads were racists, and they certainly wouldn't think of themselves as such. But in a way, they are. Because fundamentally they see lower skilled, lower paid migrant workers as less important. It's true. Just to come back to that, I mean, absolutely I agree we should oppose Islamism, you know, and you know, not just Islamism, I mean, I think religion itself, not just Islam, you know, all religious ideas are essentially reactionary and divisive. However, the problem is that the kind of terms you use when you're expressing it sort of associate the entire community with the politics of a bunch of self-selected community leaders, you know, the Muslim Council of Britain, whatever. Now, of course those people are reactionaries, but that should not at all affect our position to be adamantly against immigration controls and absolutely against the offensive of the Labour government, against those people's freedom of speech and, you know, indeed in deporting people. It's, you know, we shouldn't base our politics on thinking like, well, you know, the Labour Party are sort of right-wing social democrats, but they're kind of secular, whereas like Islamists are really right-wing and homophobic and sexist. They absolutely are, and we should support those in those communities. And there's plenty of people in the so-called Muslim community. In the Bengali community in the East End of London, there are a lot of people who fight against sexism and homophobia. And, you know, a lot of them are involved in a worker organisation. Of course, we should support them. And, you know, we shouldn't just say, oh, this guy represents Muslims because he's an imam, so, you know, he's a friend of the left. Not at all. I totally reject that kind of politics. It's patronising, it's racist, seeing all...
Excuse me. Do you think maybe we could, like... Do you think maybe you can maybe speak a bit less? I don't actually have something
to say right now.
It's just that you are speaking a lot.
Oh, I know.
Actually, there's probably other people in the room.
Oh,
well.
Sorry. Yeah, I agree.
That's okay.
No. That's fair enough. Sorry. I have made the point anyway, which is we should be against Islamists, but that's not that we should reject their sort of pretense to be representative of the whole community. Yeah. Sorry, did you?
Anybody else? He wasn't spoken. Yeah, go on, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say that there's danger of kind of getting into like a false divide where we think that like you either have to accept that like there's an imminent danger that like the Islamists are going to take over, which is obviously nonsense, or else you say like we're not a threat and they're not a threat, rather, and so we shouldn't oppose them because the problem is capitalism, where it's like the BNP are not about to take over the country tomorrow, but we still oppose them because they're reactionaries. We shouldn't fall into the trap of saying that like the lesser enemy is no longer an enemy. We should oppose all forms of reactionary politics and should be very clear about the fact that we're like opposing Islamism, not because we think it's a major political force, but because we recognise it's a small but reactionary political force and should be opposed in those terms. The other point was on the subject of kind of like mainstream and liberal anti-fascism and how the BNP gets votes. I think as David said, one crucial part of the BNP's appeal was that it's able to protect itself as being radical and being an alternative to Labour, and I think this is like one of the key points where like Unite Against Fascism and Hope Against Hate strategy falls down, as well as the fact that like it's never going to challenge Labour or anything. I think it is inherently limited in its challenge even to the BNP, because a lot of the time what the BNP is saying basically comes down to like, vote for us, we're very different to the mainstream parties. And then when you look at what Unite Against Fascism and Hope Not Hate to say, a lot of the time what they're saying is don't vote for the BNP, they're very different to the mainstream party. So I think like when we are doing anti-fascist work, we should be prepared to challenge that and to play for the ways that the BNP are in many ways very similar to the failed mainstream parties that BNP voters are no longer willing to vote for. That means being willing to like look at the BNP's record to see where they've been sleazy in the past, to play up the extent to which they are, many of their leaders are ultimately just more politicians hoping to get on the same Westminster baby train. And the other thing is challenging the radicalism of their economics, because I think over the next few years whoever gets into power is going to have to make cuts to public services. They're going to have to do that because that's what the logic of the capitalist economy requires. In an interesting turn recently, the Liberal Democrats abandoned a lot of their promises, which is kind of a record for politicians. Normally they wait until after the election to abandon their promises, but now they've come out and said, yes, we had all these brilliant plans to do stuff with money, but now we're obviously not going to be able to do that. So if we get in, we'll basically pave the same way that the Tories will and that Labour will, and we should play up the fact that it's not just that the BNP don't have any answers, it's that they're structurally unable to offer answers, because the only way they can do that is by challenging the logic of the market, which then I don't think they're willing to do.
Anybody else? Yeah.
Just a few random thoughts, really. I think the one thing that differs between the BNP and the EDL appears to me to be the attitude to the current kind of war, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, basically the imperial resource wars in the Middle East, and the BNP has always, you know, opposed that, but the EDL seems to be very much kind of almost like cheerleaders for the war on terror, and a kind of mirror image of the Al-Mujahideen front group, Islam for All. And yeah, the extent to which the speed at which they've grown and the extent to which the police have aided their demonstrations, and the same can obviously be said for Islam for All and Al-Mujahideen, does kind of make you ponder who's backing these organisations. There's also the kind of mainstream media. It was about 4-6 months ago now, there was a by-election in Norwich, and one of the candidates was Craig Murray, the British ambassador, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, who has kind of very much been quite prominent in the anti-war movement as speaking out against war, and speaking out against the use of torture by Western intelligence agencies in the war on terror. And he didn't get any coverage at all on the BBC about, you know, he was a candidate in this election, but the BNP got lots of coverage, and the BNP get interviewed, the BNP gets promoted by the BBC, but Craig Murray didn't. So yeah, there's as well as all the stuff that's been discussed tonight, I think there's some other stuff going on behind the scenes that we're probably not aware of.
Yeah. When just before the last election, last council elections, Labour got a load of publicity out saying don't vote for the BNP with a fist with BNP, and like it's putting the image out, isn't it? We're scared with this evil fascist kid brother, so vote for us. We're kind. This country's killed. How many in Iraq? How many in Afghanistan? What do you need to do? How many do you need to kill to become called a fascist? What you were saying earlier about we're very close maybe to becoming a fascist state. How many do you need to kill to become a fascist state? 100,000? 200,000?
Yeah, well, you're quite right that killing people doesn't define you as a fascist, because imperialism and the capitalist state throughout the years has killed an awful lot of people. Certainly can rival the Nazi regime if you look at the history of American imperialism or British imperialism. Certainly in terms of deaths, they can certainly rival the Nazis in Germany. And that's the whole point, that we can't just see the BNP as some alien force, something completely different from normal capitalism, because it isn't. The Nazis, I mean, the fascists historically were an expression of the capitalist state. I mean, a lot of people think, well, when the fascists took over, that wasn't capitalism. Well, it was. I mean, their aim was to defend capitalism. It is true that they always had a kind of left-wing face. If you look at, say, the German fascists, they had the brown shirts, who were a kind of unemployed workers' force. They had anti-capitalist ideology. They didn't love capitalism. Obviously, they were recruiting the unemployed. They were recruiting working-class people, just like the BNP do, with anti-capitalist rhetoric. But, you know, when push came to shove, those people were dealt with, because fascism was there to protect capitalism. And when it came down to it, in order to rule, in order to be invited into power, Hitler and Mussolini had to deal with their left wing, their anti-capitalist wing. Gregor Strasser was a famous Nazi, but he was also very left wing. If you listen to some of his rhetoric, he seemed to be anti-capitalist, but he was dealt with in the Night of the Long Knives. They killed them all because Hitler was invited to take over, and the price for that was getting rid of his left wing. Fascism is there. Capitalism always in crisis. When it's the structural crisis, economic crisis, it can turn into a strong state, so it can go to military dictatorship, or it can go to fascism. Capitalism doesn't stand on democracy. If you look at, say, some of the liberal theorists, Hayek, for example, Margaret Thatcher's hero, if you read his books, democracy is not integral to his theory. He doesn't even think trade unions should exist. He's not saying you should go out and shoot trade unionists, but he's saying he'd prefer trade unions didn't exist. He didn't see the point in them. And if you look at monetarism, where did it start? It started in Chile. That's where monetarism started. That's where the neoliberal world started, in Chile, when they butchered the working class. But I think the other thing to understand, if you look at Chile or in the 1970s, or if you look at Italy in the 1920s or Germany in the 1930s, why were the fascists successful? Well, the answer is that they weren't successful because they were street fighters, because they beat socialists and communists up. Well, they did, but that wasn't the reason that they got into power. Because one of the main reasons they got into power is because the left, the reformists, helped them. Look at Allende. He disarmed the workers. You know, they formed councils, or cordons as they called them, where local factories got together, ready to run the economy, they wanted to be socialists, they wanted to overturn capitalism. But Allende frustrated that, his socialist party. They disarmed the workers, they said, we trust in democracy, we trust the generals will defend democracy. And it was only because of those actions, disarming the working class, frustrating the working class goes on the defensive, and then you get fascism, or you get military dictatorship. In Germany, some people say, well, fascism was a response to revolution. Well, it wasn't. Because in 1918, there was a revolution in Germany. Who defeated that? Well, the German Labour Party did. It employed all these ex-soldiers, the kind of people who have the same ideas as Griffin and the rest of them, to shoot down the workers. And they shot the Rosa Luxemburg and the other main leaders. And they destroyed that revolution in 1918. And then in 1923, there was another situation where the workers could have gone the advance and could have taken over society. But again, it wasn't street fighting that destroyed it. What destroyed it was reformism, German social democracy, the Labour Party of Germany. They destroyed it because it frustrated the efforts of the workers, left them in limbo, and then left the fascists to take over. So, bash the fash. Well, I think every movement that wants to challenge the capitalist state or challenge capitalism, you've got to defend yourselves. Obviously, you've got, whether it's from the police or whether it's from fascists, you have to have people who are prepared to bash the fash or bash the police. You have to defend your communities. You have to defend your organisations. But that's a tactic. It's not a strategy. You can't rely on a strategy of bashing the fash. For example, in Barnsley, you're not going to go to those council estates and those workers have been misled by fascists to beat them all up. Well, one, you can't do it. There isn't enough of you. It's a rotten tactic anyway. So, it's got to be a political answer. You've got to put forward an alternative as communists. Yeah, of course, we're not Muslims, We're not religious, we're atheists. Far communists are atheists. But we've got, as you said, we've got to keep things in proportion. Don't focus so much on imams and Muslims and so on. They're not the threat in this country. Okay, they're not the threat in this country. What is the problem here is
capitalist crisis and capitalist austerity, and all the main bourgeois parties are going to carry it out, cuts and attacks on working class living standards, and the fascists are going to get more support in response to that. And it's our job to kind of counter that, isn't it? To organise on a different basis, organise on a communist basis or a socialist basis.
Don't we need to know the nature of this fascism you're talking about? Don't we know, have a historical experience to understand what this fascism is, why they grow? A part of the, you know, what you're saying now, I don't disagree. But the fascism, this idea of the Second World after the victorious imperialist power made it, and they've been in a way diverting all the struggles in Europe, is for the last 60 years. There's something like called fascism, and we have to be careful not to end it there. Because the very same imperialist power, they have to insist in the nature of the Second World was victorious people were on the good side and they defeated this fascism. And that is the just benefits of this ruling capitalist last 6 years. They've been benefiting from this idea. It was a capitalist world, a massacre was a capitalist, and the system is now is a capitalist. That fascism is a specific reflection of the capitalist state in a crisis period. But the rest of it is just capitalist. There is nothing else. Yeah. Social relationship is now, to my mind, is a capitalist. Yeah. And that is what we need to oppose. Yeah. Not anything like you oppose my saying by saying, do you understand fascism? There is something really is going to scare me. Oh, that's coming. I better just vote this Labour Party. Yeah. No. 60. Yeah. Majority of the people in Europe are socialists, but we're not even taken one single step last 60 years ahead. Yeah. Why we haven't done?
No, I'll continue. Sorry, come on. But yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, the Second World War is this myth of, you know, democracy versus fascism. Weren't our political establishment great fighting the fascists? I mean, it's absolute rubbish because Churchill hated Jews. He made this speech in Parliament saying, if I was in Mussolini's Hitler, I too would don the black shirt. He shared a lot of the values of fascism. The only reason he wanted to fight it was because it threatened the British Empire. And the whole point about this so-called democratic fight against fascism is that in Britain, the workers' movement was integrated into the capitalist state and was reformist after the war and stopped any kind of radical challenge to capitalism. And throughout Europe, as you quite rightly say, you had possibilities there of transcending capitalism. But what stopped it? Well, democracy did. And democracy was counter-revolutionary in that situation where you had communists and socialists throughout Europe who wanted to challenge and overthrow capitalism. And the reason it was stopped was because of democracy. And in that situation, democracy was counter-revolutionary. I agree with your points about this myth about the Second World War and, you know, the democratic fight against fascism. And the Spanish Civil War showed that, didn't it? In the Spanish Civil War, unfortunately, the anarchist leaders actually swallowed this argument that you couldn't fight capitalism and fascism simultaneously. And the fascist leaders, the anarchist leaders, they joined the state and they joined the Republican capitalist state because they said that was the lesser evil, and you had to fight fascism. You couldn't fight capitalism simultaneously. Now, that's complete nonsense, because how do you fight capitalism? You give the workers the land, you give the workers the factories. You know, but you couldn't do that if you were fighting on the basis of bourgeois democracy, if you were fighting on the basis of Republican Spain. And that's why they lost. I mean, for example, when the fascists first moved against the Republic, if freedom had been given to Morocco, then the fascist rebellion wouldn't have even got off the ground. But they couldn't do that because it was a bourgeois republic and they supported imperialism. But the point is, the left and the anarchist leaders, and I'm not making that in a kind of sectarian spirit, because you know, I can talk about what Lenin did in Russia, but it doesn't discredit communism the same way.
Anarchist leaders.
A few anarchist leaders in Spain doesn't discredit anarchism. I'm not making it in a sectarian spirit. I'm just saying that's a fact. And we mustn't make that mistake again. You have to fight fascism, but you have to fight capitalism simultaneously, because fascism is an aspect of capitalism. Because in Spain, it showed it quite clearly, didn't it, where The democratic capitalists, the democratic bourgeoisie, the republicans, the parliamentarians preferred fascism to workers' power or to communism and socialism. They did. So, you know. Anybody else?
Can I go in? Yeah.
Sorry, this comrade, then you. Yeah, sorry.
Clearly, the kind of history of the Second World War, it needs properly kind of understanding, doesn't it? And it keeps coming up. Just one kind of comment on that, and this is something that has come up on Indie Media. Just recently, just in the last few days, there was a big anti-fascist demonstration in Dresden against fascists that have this kind of annual march in Dresden. And I think this I haven't been reading it closely, but I think this year for first time I can remember, kind of the anti-fascists kind of had enough numbers that they kind of defeated the fascists. I remember last year when it came up, there were some articles about it on Indie Media, and there's this kind of crazy situation where you had anti-fascists from some, obviously just some, I think it might have been the anti-German, anti-fascists from Germany, actually, you know, talking out, supporting the bombing of Dresden and saying it was a good thing and that it's really bad that the fascists are out having their demonstration opposing the firebombing of Dresden, and that actually, you know, this was, you know, we should have supported the Allies in their bombing of Dresden, and that's, you know, it's just like, you know, it's, you know, slap yourself on the forehead. It's just like, you know, for fuck's sake, you know, this is just it was clearly an atrocious atrocity. It was, you know, it was a genocidal act comparable to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and you know, and the Second World War clearly was fundamentally an imperialist war. And yeah, I mean, it seems bizarre that, you know, 2010 and we're on this, but you know, the Second World War is still important, because look at, say, the way that the likes of Searchlight use the Second World War and other kind of anti-fascists, kind of this kind of thing about trying to portray the BNP and whoever as Nazis, and it's actually kind of going along with the kind of demonisation of, well, it's kind of going along with the mainstream kind of understanding of the Second World War, which is a very simplistic, they were bad, we were good kind of, you know, understanding of the Second World War. And yeah, it's, there you go.
Can I just ask is this coming? And then you, yeah.
I'm in fact ask a question again. In your next, can you, in your mind, two communists should have taken part in the war, in the Second War, in the so-called fascist war?
No. Yeah, I'm glad that there seems to be some kind of movement towards, because usually I'm used to speaking to Trotskyists on the Second World War, and there's this false dichotomy of, I call it, false opposition between the need to defend democracy and so on. So I'm glad that there seems to be some clarity, isn't that? Because also, when we're talking about fascism, we're saying fight fascism simultaneously. Well, fascism to me, and it's like the historical phenomenon which it arrives, was nothing more than the rearguard of capitalism, which is when capitalism in its last throes, what is needed to defend it was what we experienced in Europe and that. And also, as the gentleman next to me says, in the kind of half a century since then, we've seen these huge campaigns from crankstates of kind of the danger of these taking power, and we also see it in the left and this utter fetishism really of any kind of far right group that moves and the threat that they pose, which is, we must ask the question, as revolutionaries, communists, etc., how should our class respond to this? And we must start out from the departure that our activity must be that which strengthens our class within capitalist society in order, in the day-to-day context of defending ourselves against the attacks are undoubtedly going to come, and in order for the struggle to take power eventually. And that should be our departure point, not following round whatever march demo that these far-right groups call, because it is ultimately that
when our class struggles as a class for power, we will undoubtedly come into conflict with far-right groups, but we are not strengthening our class by simply tail-ending these kind of demonstrations and so on.
Anybody else? Yeah,
something that interests me and that I don't really have a good answer to is like, you know, how to actually organise against the likes of the BNP, against fascism, the rise of fascism. I haven't made up my own mind in terms of like the best way of going about that, because obviously things have changed and the BNP has like made a move from, you know, like street level politics, as Sam was saying, to suits and ties. And I don't know whether the EDL represents a kind of return to street politics for fascism as well. I don't know if that's the case or not. And also where the National Front, where they stand on this, because they're, you know, arguably becoming more well established again now. So really, I don't know if anyone else has thought about this and has better ideas of like the best way to go about it, but it is something that confuses me. And I do like look at kind of the rise of fascism, I look at how well they seem to be doing, and it does kind of scare me, but I don't know the best way to combat it, you know. So I don't know if anyone else has anything to say on that in particular.
Any response to that?
I think that certainly our best response is not being opposed to it per se, like being opposed to BNP as BNP. It's understanding why the BNP is popular. What is it that the people associate with in the BNP, and trying to deal with it on that level rather than just being like blanket anti-fascist, which is just to completely ignore any other kind of level of analysis.
Yeah, you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, the BNP, from what I can see, from having looked at their website, which I just decided to do just to see what their, you know, what their public face is like, they very much ascribe a lot of our problems to immigration. They say a lot of Britain's problems to immigration. They say, oh, you know, why is there a recession? Oh, immigration. Why is there a housing problem? Oh, immigration. Why is the environment being ruined? Immigration. And I suppose to some people, the simplicity of that explanation is really, really attractive. It's like, oh, you know, oh, they've hit the nail on the head. You know, now we know why our problems are happening, and we can do something about it. So I think it's probably challenging that myth that, you know, the myth that it is immigration which is causing all of this, because it's a very, very simple view, and it's, you know, maybe to a lot of people that's really attractive, but you need to challenge that view, because it's not the right one, and it's one that's just obviously very dangerous in the sense that it could lead to a, you know, a BNP government in the extremes.
I absolutely agree with what you're saying. We have to just counter their arguments and use our own politics, you know, whether that's communist or anarchist, rather than say vote Labour or they're not respectable and they're Nazis or whatever. We just answer the arguments, and as you say, and be ourselves. And that's the problem with the left in Britain, isn't it? That it hasn't done that. It's been terribly defensive, vote Labour or vote anything apart from the BNP. It's not exactly a confidence in your own alternative point of view. You've got to have confidence in your own alternative point of view, your own independent communist point of view, in my case, for example, or other comrades. As you say, counter the arguments, you know, and that's a really important thing to do, rather than just engage in lesser evil politics, lesser evil, this Green politician or that Labour politician is better than this Nazi, but that is a complete dead end. It's a waste of time. We've got to argue how we can represent workers, how we can build a workers' movement, how we can fight back for people's interest against the state and against bourgeois politicians. Anybody else? Yeah, again.
I just want to say in response to that, it does. I think that's the part of the problem is that people see the simple answer as vote this, And it's really appealing to just think, oh, I can solve my own, I can solve my conscience by voting for Labour, because that will help sort out this BNP problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you were saying, it's got to be organised, you know, at a different level. It's not as simple as vote for this person and all your problems will go away. We have to, like, problems, can look at problems at our own level and see how we can counter them on a local scale rather than on this national grand scale of all the government will sort everything out. So we need to instill in people more faith of their own ability to sort their lives out.
Absolutely, because you've got to have confidence in ordinary people being able to transform themselves and fight against this thing. Anybody else? Any other points?
I'd like to add, although I don't think the way to tackle the BNP is through parliamentary democracy, I think you need to look at how the left, I think the rise of the BNP is something to do with the failures of the left. How the left since, I don't know, 96 has failed to make an alternative due to its own sectarianism. So I think some people who would consider themselves anti-fascist need to look at themselves and need to realise it's their own failure to unite on socialist politics that's it's got something to do with our failure to counter the BNP, and it's why the British National Party, I can't remember when they were formed, but they've been together ever since I can remember, and all the attempts of the left to unite have all fallen apart, and we've got Tusk coming up in the elections and they're going to have a very minimal impact, whereas the British National Party, who everyone in the country knows of, you know, they're like a household name, they've been around forever, that's going to be another reason for their electoral success.
But do you think electoralism is the answer?
No, I don't think that's the, I do not think that's the answer, but I feel maybe a united left, wasn't so sectarian, that had more links in the community, like we've been saying, that would it could pose more of a response to the BNP.
I mean, I know in Germany and Italy, in the interwar years, the actual voting for the Socialist and Communist parties actually rose. But it actually,
in the scales of things, it didn't make any bloody difference, you know. But so what you're saying? How do you think that left can unite then at the grassroots level? Do you think that's going to be possible with all these small sects?
I just think. I think the left's got to abandon sectarianism. I think that's the first thing. It's important. That's one of the things that strikes me when I first came to the left. It was sectarianism.
Yeah.
So I think.
But can you unite all the? You know, some people have the perspective of uniting all these little groups. Do you think that's possible?
Possibly. It would be quite a project, I suppose.
Yeah, please, questions. Well, I think it's a $6 million question. I mean, okay, fascism or bourgeois democracies are all different facets of capitalism and imperialism, okay. And we know that to sort of get to socialism, you need the masses. You cannot rely on two small fringe groups here and there. And with the problems of the world and society at the moment, with rampant individualism, apathy, and you name it, and with capitalism having got all the instruments and the ideologues and, you know, the ideology brainwashing people constantly, how can we achieve that goal? Let's not forget that I'm sure we none of us believe in determinism, that we can actually instrumentalize and create a mass uprising ourselves. So how do we get from here to there? And what's the question of what should we do?
Well, I hope somebody's going to answer that question. But I think we have to have confidence that ordinary people can realize their potential.
Potentially, yes, they can.
I think in terms of inspiration, you can look at it around, can't you? Against all the odds. What those people do on the streets and so on. You're quite right to point out all those things about you know, the current situation where you've got rampant individualism and all the rest of it. But we have to be confident that we can change things and people can change. And history shows us that. It shows us great surprises where people seem to be downtrodden and oppressed, sometimes for decades, and then suddenly things will change. Anybody else?
Certainly, voting, election won't help to get there, you know, that, you know, from here to there, we don't know exactly what to do, and I'm sure people in here, no one can claim, you know, we've got it. We can't, because there is no movement, so we can't. But we know certain things won't do. Election won't do. Taking part in election, not now, 10 years ago was wrong, and that is not going to come. And point that you were raising, I think even if did, it is very impossible to, you know, this lefties to come together. Even if they did come together, the result would be nothing desirable at all. You know, it's, you know, you put, you know, so many weaknesses next to each other, they're going to reinforce their own weakness. But that's not something ideal we would go. The question is to understand the situation. That is comes without understanding, and you know, the situation, we won't be able to take a step ahead.
I think the threat of fascism in the near medium future is clearly going to grow due to the multiple crises that are unfolding globally, in terms of, there's obviously economic collapse, climate change, peak oil, ecological destruction, etc., etc. It's just to kind of remind everyone about all that stuff, really. And I think that there's a danger that, you know, people turn to demagogic right-wing blame this section of society type, you know, leaders. There's a danger that obviously the state can use that, those kind of leaders at times of crisis to, as people have said, is a kind of, you know, bourgeois, you know, last form of resort for kind of bourgeois democracy.
Defining an in-group and defining an out-group when push comes to shove, defining an in-group, and that in-group takes resources off the out-group at a psychological level. That's how it works.
Yep, sorry.
Something else that, whilst I agree that electoralism is like no way to kind of like bring about our eventual aims, I do wonder what people here feel about the idea of using, you know, the idea of promoting the use of a person's vote to stop the BNP getting into power in whatever like area. I kind of like feel myself that like there's an obvious danger there, in that you are kind of legitimizing the system by promoting the use of the vote, and in that sense I would kind of like argue against doing that. But I'm not entirely certain, you know, I'm interested in what other people have to say on that, maybe.
Anybody else? David, and then this comment.
I mean, just very briefly on that part, I mean, I agree with the rejection of the idea. But in a way, it's not only that, kind of in a general sense, we wouldn't want to encourage people to have illusions that voting Labour will change anything, but also that a specific problem is because the BNP are so electoralist, you know, their big strategy is, you know, to take over little bits of the state, which is obviously much more worthwhile for them than just going around beating people up, because the state is much more powerful than any kind of group of people in the streets. But a lot of people become BNP voters having become disillusioned with Labour. You know, Gordon Brown says British jobs for British workers. Then people see, well, that, you know, there's no jobs. And the BNP say, you know, we really mean British jobs for British workers. In a way, that reflects a real concern with unemployment. So for us to then go out and say to those people, oh, you better not vote Nazi, you should vote Labour, it's like a total dead end. It just associates us with the people who are the problem. So, you know, I'd be
in terms of like the far left organising electorally, like I think it's you know, I wouldn't be on principle opposed to participating in elections, but like left groups who take part in elections never stand against immigration controls. So you could have all the left groups together in one party, but unless they change the politics, there's no point.
I think that rather than going around trying to like stop the BNP getting elected by persuading anti-fascists to vote, which I think we can all agree is dead end, it's much more productive to go around trying to persuade BNP supporters, or at least potential BNP supporters, that they shouldn't vote, which is a lot easier, no, a lot harder rather to do than just trying to persuade lefties that they should bother to vote Labour instead of not bothering to vote. But ultimately, if we do want to beat the fascists, we do need to like confront the reasons why people are supporting them and argue against their ideas, and that means taking on people who support them and explaining that BNP don't offer any answers to their problems, and that is a way of potentially stopping them getting elected without being forced into these dodgy shitty alliances with Labour Party or whatever. That I think should be our priority in this area.
Just
on the election, I think whether it's fascists elected there or whether communists are elected there, parliament is the institution for capitalism, and it will digest whatever gets into it to a capitalist policy. If it suits him, like it did in the 60s, they will make it kind of state capitalism. If it suits them, like in the 80s, they will make it free capitalism or sometimes even fascist. But nonetheless, the nature of fascism or nature of left, so-called social democrats in the parliament is nothing but the capitalism. Mm-hmm. So if a communist by principle never ever will go with the parliament, because the parliament is designed for that. Representative never, not now, even the last century, wasn't suitable for the working class. Working class had a method of having delegate, bourgeois, in fact, Tories in this country, they brought more this election business, and they so, you know, they say it's a sense of democracy because it suits them. Parliament, the election, suits capitalism, and never working class ever gonna be able to take as even a step, to my mind. Even, you know, Lenin and others, they were at that sometimes in Russia, they were saying, okay, it will be a step. But even if it was true then, today certainly not. With this parliament now, whether it is in UK or in Russia or wherever, it's just a bunch of gangsters there in order to organize the capital system, nothing more than that.
Yeah, Tommy.
Yeah, I am just coming on the elections and National Union on Parliament. Yeah, I totally agree there that Parliament is not an institution through which the working class can express its interests, because when you have much of the left, when they seem to argue around like revolution primary, that it's just a platform for them to spout propaganda, well, I think as like I'm not sure who said, but you don't go in the wrong direction to prove you're wrong by entering into Parliament. So yeah, I believe Parliament has an objective function in bourgeois society. It is to administrate that society and mediate the differences between different factions of the bourgeoisie. And on left unity, like my comrade said there, that I'm for communist unity, but it must be on a political basis. It must be like I would have serious differences with various groups on questions like trade unions, national liberation, and so on. So it must be on a political basis that groups come together.
Any other comments?
It's more important than groups coming together is having a strong argument against the policies of BNP and alike, and the capitalism in general. And I think that's been the biggest shortcoming of the left, that's not being able to sell its ideas and argue, present a stronger argument against those and sell it to the masses, sell it to the people.
Yeah.
Which form it is going to take, yes, I personally disagree with taking part in a parliament as an instrument, but some people believe in it as using it just as a platform. if it is merely taken as a platform, possibly at, in some circumstances, I don't know. I don't have a clear example to say. But
it's got quite a lot of rotten planks at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I'm talking hypothetically. In general, you can say, I'm never going to use Parliament. I mean, but we can use it as a platform here and there, and it has to be right. It has to be argued that it's the right time and the right situation for it. But the main, what's been missing the last few decades since the Second World War is the left, the communists, the socialists, and the like have not been able to win the arguments, to present it and sell it to the masses. I think if we concentrate our energies more on the positive and in the lines of what should be done, like Lenin did, I think that's going to be a more fruitful.
Yeah, I think that point has come out quite a lot in this debate.
Sorry, I was late.
I think a lot of people have agreed with you this evening in the meeting. That point's come out quite a lot. Any more contributions? Are we all done then?
Just going to say that there seems to be this idea that the reason the far right is so strong is that they're united, and the reason the far left however we choose to see ourselves are so weak is because we're divided, and don't think that's true. If you look at the far right, they're kind of incredibly divided. You've got the BNP, the EDL, and then you've got like the National Front, British People's Party, Racial Volunteer Force, and aside from all these tiny fact book groups that don't matter that much, even the BNP, they do have kind of constant splits and internal feuding. So the reason they're so much stronger is something different to that. I'd argue one of the major reasons is that they've got an incredibly favourable climate, because the mainstream newspapers do put out sort of light versions of BNP policy, which we're not going to have happening to us anytime soon. So.
Okay. Any more, David?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is true that the left would get better election results if it's the same name every time and so on, which is something the BNP do, right? And as I said before, they do like community newsletters, all that kind of stuff. But the main weakness of the left is political and tailing the Labour Party, which you see now every, all the big Trotskyist groups going back to voting Labour and so on, to the Socialist Party. But I think in general, a lot of people here obviously agree we shouldn't at all say, oh, let's defend like ordinary capitalism or bourgeois democracy against fascism or so on, but you see those things as interlinked and essentially the same idea. That's why the BNP's ideas have resonance, because basically under capitalism and with a weak workers' movement, a lot of people have very nationalist and statist ideas, and the BNP just represents an extreme of that. So the thing I'd say, though, is that I think although we shouldn't at all defend one set of capitalists against another, or Labour against the BNP, whatever, I think we shouldn't just say kind of socialism's the answer. It's important to take on racism on its own terms. It's something very real in society now, which has a very direct effect on the very large number of migrant workers in Britain. So we shouldn't just say black and white unite and fight or that kind of thing. Racism, deportations, all that is very specific, needs to be fought in its own terms. Of course it's linked to a communist perspective of society or indeed even just the idea of revitalising the workers' movement. But though migrant workers really don't get much of a hearing in the workers' movement, militant trade unionism is not enough, often ignores those workers. So I really think what I'd really stress, and I hope in the commune we've sort of shown a bit of this recently, is it's very important, if you have anti-statist politics, to stress the struggle against immigration controls, which are not just kind of at Calais and Dover and so on,
but you know, within workplaces used to attack migrant workers. I think we should be absolutely in solidarity with the migrant workers who are self-organising.
Okay, is that it then? We've exhausted it. Okay, well, for this evening anyway. Right, thanks comrades. That was a very good debate, and I think everyone's had their say. So we need to think about